and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this fine Tuesday. It's bright Tuesday because this is bright week. Did you know this is bright week, Michael?
I did. I spent a lot of time in the Eastern Catholic Church, so the language rubs off.
So you know all that. Okay, good. I astonished Sherry Antonetti yesterday with that intelligence. So
nice.
I live to enlighten. So anyway, it is Tuesday, a bright week, the week after Easter. And we are here today with, in addition to my co-host, whose voice you just heard, Michael Litchens, we are also here with Sister Rose Bacotti. She is a daughter of St. Paul. She's the founding director of the Pauline Center for Media Studies in Los Angeles. She's a media literacy education specialist, as well as being an award-winning author, film critic, and most recently a TV host. She's written or co-written several books on scripture and film study guides, and two books on media literacy. She's written biographies of Martin Sheen and Coretta Kent, and she's working on right now a biography of St. Hildegard of Bingen, our most recent female doctor of the church. So, welcome, Sister Rose Bacotti. How you doing?
Oh, very well, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. You're speaking to us from the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas, as I understand it.
Yeah, and my sister and brother-in-law have 3 acres here, and they have 3 rescue donkeys and a lab and a half and random wildlife. They have a couple of roosters and non-laying chickens and all kinds of interesting things. We don't know why the chickens don't lay, but anyway, there you have it. Hello? 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 Hello?
You know,
absolutely.
I had I had chocolate, which was like a big thrill, you know, and a lot of eggs. Eaten a fair number of eggs, but that's like not really. That's not that big of a deal for me. One of the things that goes with being a diabetic is you wind up eating a lot of eggs, but.
I was going to say that's usually also for me when I had far less income. That means it was the 3 days till payday.
So, yeah.
Oh, it's all eggs this week. Okay.
Well, little protein balls. So that's what you want. Danny, do we have Sister back yet? Or is, okay, great. All right. Sister, you there?
I am here. Yes.
Hello again. Hello. I was going to ask you just when you... When you say rescue donkey.
Oh, you want to know what those are?
Well, all I can picture is like a donkey with like one of those little St. Bernard barrels around his neck. And he goes out in the mountains and finds lost travelers. But that's probably not what a rescue donkey is.
It's my sister and brother-in-law who go around with these little barrels on their neck. No, no. What happened is that they have this 3 acres, and they noticed in the newspaper or something that a donkey had been rescued from an abusive situation and was asking if anybody would take it. So they took it, mostly for really selfish purposes called fertilizer. And to keep the grass cut.
Yeah.
And then about a year later, two more came. They weren't from an abusive situation, just his family was moving and couldn't keep them. So now they have three.
Three rescue donkeys. I think that's super cool. So you're out there in your mountain paradise, working on your book on St. Hildegard of Bingen, right?
That's right.
So can you give us some previews about the book?
Well, I'm fascinated by Hildegard, and I have been. I know about her because of the books we carry in our Pauline bookstores across the country. That's a little product placement plug right there. Uh-huh. But then I reviewed a film that came out maybe 5 years ago called Vision from the Life of Hildegard of Bingen. It was a German film by a woman named Von Trotta, her last name Von Trotta. And I have to tell you, I was just fascinated by it. This woman was a musician. She was an herbalist. She, in the sense that she knew a lot of folk medicine, what we would call folk medicine, or natural mm-hmm. medicine nowadays. She mm-hmm. was a writer. She had visions from the time she was 3 years old. And her visions were confirmed while she was alive by the Pope, Pope Eugene III. And she was a Benedictine. And she started off as an anchoress, and then by the time the first anchoress at this monastery had died, there were 15 or maybe 12 sisters there, and they got too big and, too many, and they had to, at some point, she asked to found their own monastery, and of course that was not permitted because guess where all the nuns' dowries went? Went to the guys. And they weren't happy about that, but she, again, between the Archbishop of Mainz in Germany and the Pope, she got permission to found her own monastery and to become independent of the male monastery. And this was really new. This is in the 1100s or the 12th century. It's almost a millennium ago. And yet she is more popular now than she ever was. Okay, the New Agers like her because she would talk about the energy in stones and, of course, her medicine. But, that's people co-opting it, I think, for their own purposes.
Right.
However, what she has to, scientifically, what she observes or has to say, still stands today. She's not wrong. She's right so many times. But anyway, as a musicologist, and she wrote these letters. She took four tours, preaching tours in the Rhineland, and she even went into what is now France in the province of Lorraine. And I have to tell you, she spoke truth to power. Man, those guys didn't like it. she didn't make the bishops happy. She didn't make the clergy happy. She didn't make heretics happy. She was very bold, and she wasn't without her flaws, especially by contemporary judgment. We would see with a limited vision, and an example of that is that she only wanted noble women or women of means in her community because she loved harmony, and she felt that women of the same social status would be better in a community rather than mixing in the poor with them. And she was called on that by other abbesses, but she held to that. To the point that, 20 years before she died, she crossed the Rhine and founded another monastery. And presumably that was for poorer women who wanted to join her because she was like a medieval rock star. She was tremendously popular. She healed people, and of course her visions, and that's why when she wrote her visions or dictated them, nobody's quite sure if it was a mixture of both or how that worked, but the theology, her theology was very Catholic in her theology. She was not a revolutionary, she was a reactionary. In other words, when stuff happened, she reacted to it. She was very much a woman of the Gospels, of the Scriptures, and of the teachings of the Church. And so that's what she expounded. But she also had insights, you know, from her love of nature. I have to tell you, if anybody's ever named a patron saint of the environment, it'll probably be Hildegard of Bingen. Because she had this, she had this concept of the green, of verdant, and she saw Mary, you know, the fruitfulness, and so, and the cosmos. She had this grand view of the cosmos that Teilhard de Chardin, you know, later on in the 20th century would reflect. And I don't know, if you like church history, you will love Hildegard. If you, I'm sorry, I have no control over what's going on here. In my environment right now, so I have to wait till that picks up. But and it's probably a telemarketer from the IRS threatening a lawsuit. That happens every day here. So any, you know, those scams that are going on. So anyway, that's why I'm writing about Hildegard, because she's, like you said, the fourth woman who's been named a doctor of the church. They were all nuns, except even, it is an IRS threat. It's fake. But
what's a favorite scam this time of year?
There were three. Go ahead.
We're up against the break right now, but we'll be back just a minute.
Okay.
You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Michael Litchens and Sister Rose Picotti. And we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this. To connect dots, I'm your host Mark Shea. We're here today with Mr. Michael Litchens and with our special guest, Sister Rose Picotti. If you want to join the conversation, by all means, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. Seems like every other day I open Facebook or something on Patheos or something, and there's Sister Rose, and she's like, you know, hanging out with like all these big Hollywood names and stuff, and you've written a biography of Martin Sheen, so I presume that meant that you had a lot of sit down conversations with him. I was mentioning before we went on the air, we've been rewatching The West Wing, which is just a terrific civics lesson in, you know, how the government works and what goes on, you know, well, perhaps not what goes on in this White House, but because God alone knows what goes on in this White House. I'm not sure that they know either, but it's a very well written series, Martin Sheen has a great deal of fun playing the President of the United States.
Yeah.
How did you wind up doing a biography of Martin Sheen?
Well, the editor of one of the editors at Liturgical Press contacted me and invited me to write it, and as part of their People of God series, and other people in that series, living and dead people, there are Thomas Merton, Flannery O'Connor, Dorothy Day, those Pope Francis is in that series, and so they asked me to do Martin Sheen, and through a friend, actually, even though I'd met Martin a few times, I really, you know, he's not technological. So it had to be voice of mouth. A friend of mine who's in his parish asked him if he would do that. And, he sat down with me. It was supposed to be a two-hour interview. It turned into almost five. And but then I got to interview his sister who lives in Spain. I sent her 35 questions, and I got back more than 35 pages of answers, just enriching the book tremendously. And, you know, with just minutia of the family, of them growing up. And and then I interviewed three of his brothers, two in Dayton and one in L.A. And it was wonderful. And they're just they've been, you know, they went through a lot. I think Martin Sheen was 11 when his mother died. So you can imagine, you know, to have all those kids. There was already one in the military service who was already gone from home when the mother died. But there were still, I want to say, six kids at home, six or seven when she passed. So, you know, it was a pretty devastating thing to happen. And boy, the father just took over. And he did what he needed to do and brought those kids up. All boys and one girl.
I remember his birth name is Estevez, but he took the name Sheen from Fulton Sheen, for whom he had a great admiration.
I did not know that.
The first name came from a gentleman at CBS who really gave him really good advice. He won this radio prize to go to New York when he was in high school, and he went with his brother, and he got an interview at CBS. I think that was part of the deal, because the contest that he won was for reading a story or a poem. He read a poem on the radio, and everybody voted for it. But in those days, they had to send in postcards, right? That was in the 50s. They had no you know, no electronic means. And so he won that contest. He went to New York, and he met someone at CBS whose first name was Martin. So when he realized he wasn't getting any work with Ramon Estevez, he changed it to Martin, and then Sheen for Fulton Sheen. Yes.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I remember years ago, watching him in a film called The Execution of Private Slovak.
Yeah.
Which is a really powerful film. And it's about the only American soldier shot for desertion in World War II.
That's correct.
And Eddie Slovak was, you know, yeah, he was a deserter. Other soldiers had deserted, you know, and he was kind of a, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, you know, but he was from the wrong side of the tracks, and he had a record of minor crime. And at one point, you know, he sort of, you know, makes a series of appeals, and every appeal is denied, and eventually it becomes clear that they're actually going to shoot this guy for, you know, wandering off, and he can't believe it. And at the end, at the climax of the film, he gives a speech in which he says, you know, I'm not being shot for desertion. I'm being shot because of the gum that I stole when I was 15 years old. Mm. And, you know, and it was, and it was true, you know, and, but anyway, the execution scene is just, it's a harrowing thing to watch. And he really, you know, brings across, you know, the terror of it. And he's, as he's being let out, you know, he's, there's a priest who hears his confession, and then they bring him out, and he's saying the Hail Mary the whole time, and it just tears your heart out to watch it. I thought it was a great performance. I remember it really affected me when I was, I must have been a teenager when I saw it. It was made in the 70s, mid 70s, I think. But anyway,
one or two of his brothers, that's their favorite film that he has ever made.
Really?
Yeah. For them. Yeah. You know, personally looking at his work, that's their favorite. It's not his favorite, but it is theirs. Yeah. That's a powerful film.
It is a powerful film. Yeah. Well, that brings me, you know, to something I wanted to discuss with you. You run a blog site called Sister Rose Movies blog.net. Or is it Sister Rose Movies?
No, it's Sister Rose Movies .net.
Okay. Where you can get Sister Rose's thoughts on what makes a good movie. So I figure, while I got you on the air here, I'll ask you, what makes a good movie?
Okay. I have a really pithy way to describe what a good movie is, and I taken it right off of Mother Teresa and Dom Helder Camara, and that is, a movie is a good movie when it afflicts the comfortable and comforts the afflicted.
Hmm. There are some movies that afflict the afflicted, especially really, really long ones, because it's just painful to sit there that long.
Like, oh, you mean like long sermons? Long sermons do the same thing.
Or how about those 1980s evangelical films?
The afflicted too. Oh, I'm sorry. After a beautiful Easter, I shouldn't bring that up. But anyway.
Give an example.
Yeah, you're right. Well, but some long movies I can sit through. I'm like Silence. Oh my gosh, I've seen it 4 times now, and I never felt uncomfortable in that 3-hour and 35-minute movie.
Steve Gradonis had a lot of good things to say. Steve Gradonis had a chance to talk to Martin Scorsese after a screening of that.
Yeah,
film.
I did too, and I kind of missed it, but. I did get to speak to one of the executive producers and Andrew Garfield, and I was at the screening in San Francisco when Scorsese was there. George Lucas presented the film, and then Adam Driver and Andrew Garfield were there, along with the guy who played the Inquisitor. He was brilliant, actually. Mm-hmm. So that was a wonderful panel after we saw the film. That was in early December.
So give some other examples of films that you have enjoyed.
Okay, recent.
Take your pick.
There's one coming out called, what's it called? That's really terrible. It's about this little, oh, gifted, about a little girl who's mathematically gifted, just wonderful. I loved Hidden Figures by Ted Melfi, the director, just like I love St. Vincent that came out a couple of years ago with Bill Murray. Great film. Okay. Even though, again, it might afflict some people's sensibility, but you know what? When you're looking at the human condition, sometimes for a good story, you have to go through the messiness. So that those are good ones. So on my, I love the movie Enchanted April. I love the movie Lars and the Real Girl. Henry Poole Was Here is another one that I just absolutely love with Luke Wilson. And there are just some lovely films. 12 Years as a Slave is another one that really, really got to me. And I guess the number one film I use for teaching is the John Ford film, The Searchers.
Really?
That was way back in the 50s. Oh, yeah.
I remember The Searchers. Yeah. We are up against the break again, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Michael Litchens and Sister Rose Picotti. And we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this. And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Mr. Michael Litchens and Sister Rose Picotti. And we've been talking a little bit about, you've got a blog called SisterRoseMovies.net. And you also do a lot of work with media literacy education. What is media literacy education?
Media literacy is about accessing, analyzing, evaluating, and acting and creating media. It's it's about being thoughtful in our media choices, and then when we do make a decision, that we enter into it and give it our time, our critical time of asking questions about, you know, what's the story about? What's really going on? Who's included? Who's left out? Does it make a difference? What Christian values might be present or non-present? And I'm not looking at Christian media. That's a whole different sad chapter as far as I'm concerned. But because they lead with a message rather than a story. You have to lead with a story.
Right.
That's what this is all
right.
about. But okay. that you ask questions and... what's the worldview of whoever's making this? We ultimately it's all for profit, unless it's nonprofit like our media. But even we have a worldview. Everybody has
right.
a worldview. So,
right.
and it's finding out what that is. So it enters into what it means. Like, what does the story mean? And it could mean something entirely different for everyone. Like the movie Silence, not to keep banging on the same movie, which I really love, that movie. Not everybody saw it the same way. You know, people, it's like the Tree of Life, if you remember that one, and Terrence Malick, and 50% of the people loved it, and 50% walked out. So it's everybody can see something differently, but that's okay. I think Pope Benedict said this, that media is on this big table around which we can gather to talk about things that matter. So when you have a great story, that's when you can, when you know that people are not right or wrong about how they interpret it, then you can have a conversation. And
right.
that's the thing. It's about having that conversation. And that builds
yeah.
bridges. So
yeah, I think
literacy.
You're right. That having a, starting with the story rather than here's this message that I'm going to drill into you. Going
God
back to Steve Gardonis, one of his, the banes of Steve's existence are the God's Not Dead films.
I'm telling you, when I first started reviewing movies, and Steven did too, and I don't really like to read other people's reviews, but little by little, when I see Steven on Facebook and when he puts it out there, what he thinks, and I'm going, that guy and I, we think a lot alike.
Yeah.
God is Not Dead is terrible. And it's written by two Catholics, which is the most sad thing about it to me.
Yeah, well, so much of, so much of Christian art has been, particularly in the U.S., has just been consumed with culture war garbage. We've got to win this culture war argument. And so, God forbid you tell a story because...
But there's one way to do it, Mark. There's one way to
yeah.
do it. When the emphasis is on the individual, it's always going to be attached to the culture wars.
Yeah.
When the story is about the community or about moving beyond one man's personal anguish, most of the time you're going to get a more universal story and not just something that's flooded with American issues.
Yeah. It's funny, when Tolkien was writing The Lord of the Rings, one of the things that people constantly asked him, they tried to read his stories that was an allegory. So the ring is the atomic bomb. And, the entire War of the Ring is some kind of big allegorical story about World War II. And he said, it's none of those things.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't, he first of all, he didn't like allegory. And so he refused to write an allegory. But yeah, he was telling a story about characters, and there were certain things that had to happen in that story. The ring needed to be destroyed and so forth. But so much of it, you know, he himself didn't know where the story was going. He tells a story at one point at the moment where Frodo is on the road and he hears for the first time the hooves of a horse coming toward him. Tolkien says, "I had no more idea than Frodo did who was on that horse. I thought it might be Gandalf at first, but it didn't turn out to be Gandalf." and that's interesting to me that, you know, that's how a story grows. You don't have things all worked out because everything is not subservient to some message that you're going to pound into somebody's head. And I'm getting off the track here,
if you take Flannery O'Connor, and I love Flannery O'Connor, and her whole whatever she's going to write about, I mean, she takes from the world around her, she takes from her front porch basically, and and she writes about grace working in the lives of the people who are around her or who she's met or who she can imagine that, you know, that she's met. And I think that becomes her overarching worldview is that of grace and how it enters in and how people make choices. And so I think that made her a very specific kind of storyteller, but she was also, you know, the whole thing about being Christ haunted, you know, in the South. Right. That was you know, made her a regional author of great repute. But anyway, I think that I have to try fiction. I think I need to do that. And I'm a nonfiction writer, and I write about I write nonfiction about fiction, and just
fiction
see where
is
that goes.
Hard.
That would be so interesting to have the luxury to write fiction.
I've been working on a novel for like a couple of years, and I got to tell you, fiction is super hard. You use a totally different set of muscles than you do when you're writing nonfiction. I got to write nonfiction in my sleep, especially about certain topics. I can write it. It just comes right out. But fiction, man, every step of the way is just a struggle. I have a ton of respect for fiction writers.
You know, writing biographies, especially Martin Sheen and Carita Kent and now Hildegard, you know, you have to make a decision about how you're going to do it, if you're going to just do it linear, if you're going to do it nonlinear. But fact-checking becomes an obsession, and that can kind of slow down the flow unless you're willing to just flap it out there and then fact-check it all afterwards. I guess that's got to be the writer's choice. But even when you're writing views and things, it's so easy to make some little mistakes here and there as you go along, and you know, about people's names and dates and things like that. But even if it's not always perfect, I like to do it.
One thing you could do is you could just like pick a character that you don't like, and then just casually slander them. If you just casually slander somebody you don't like, then you get practice writing fiction, and you don't have to fact check. Isn't that a great idea?
How about taking a character you really like and turning them, into becoming the fatal flaw of the story or something?
Yeah,
you know,
well,
that
you
could
can
work
do that.
Too.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think I need somebody to give me an assignment to write something fictional and be willing to make a contribution to my community for doing it. And then maybe I would do that.
Okay.
That would be great.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
But no holy moly stuff. I don't want holy moly. I just don't do that.
I don't know
what
holy moly
is. By the way, Mark, before you go to the next break,
yeah.
I want to call out to my sister-in-law, Mary King, who is listening to this broadcast, and ask her to call in. Come on, Mary. Do it. You know you want to do it. Anyway.
It's 1-573-4-BREAD-4. That's how you call in. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You too can be on the air with Sister Rose Picotti. And if you are related to Sister, you can, you know, reveal all kinds of embarrassing personal details about her on the air. It'll be great.
Okay. If my sister Libby is listening, you know, we barely ever agree on movies. And so we have this fantasy that we're going to do a show, and it's going to be called I'm Right, You're Wrong. And that's going to be our film review show.
Okay. Well, that's kind of like Siskel and Ebert, you know, you could do that.
We were going to call it Sister and Libert or something. That's what we're going to, but anyway, that's how we play around. At least we can still talk to each other after we have a drag down argument about what a film means.
Hello and welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Michael Litchens and Sister Rose Picotti. Michael, you had a question for Sister over the break.
Yeah, Sister. It's rare that I'm blown away by a movie, but I was blown away by Calvary. But I know in a lot of the Catholic world, that was a controversial film. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, I did review it, and I even got to interview Brendan Gleeson after when were trying to, circulate it for Oscar consideration, and I think it should have gotten it.
Agreed.
I thought it was a very, very sad movie, tragic movie, but I think the main character, the priest and father at the same time, I mean, there was a lot of theology going on there. Mm-hmm. And I think he was a Christ figure, and that he gave himself up. And that's probably the most controversial part is, I think after all these years, we're not giving anything away, is when he meets the guy at the beach and he knows he's going to kill him, and he goes anyway. And maybe he was going to try to reach him, or maybe some way he thought he wouldn't, but that he was sacrificing himself for that, for the good of that young man, was quite amazing. And unfortunately, it was very violent and very brutal. Mm-hmm. But if you think of the clergy abuse problem,
yes,
take that violence that we saw, because, you know, movies externalize internal realities. So what you have there is like the director, the filmmaker saying, don't be shocked at this. For every little kid who was abused by a priest, this is what happened. Mm-hmm. And then you say, oh, my God. Oh, God, help us all. Mm-hmm. And it takes on a whole different reality, a whole different meaning when you put it in the context of the clergy abuse scandal in anywhere. But, you know, Ireland, the ultra-Catholic Ireland that it used to be, can imagine.
Yeah.
When all that, and it's still unfolding. So I think that powerful film and guts to make a film like that and to still keep the theology very, very strong in the film, the redemptive theology and incarnational theology as well. So.
Yeah.
Agreed.
That reminds me, I wanted to talk about this next. I wanted to discuss with you because there's a great line in A Man for All Seasons where Henry VIII sits down with Sir Thomas More, and at one point in their conversation, Henry says to Thomas, "You have excellent taste, Thomas. It exactly coincides with my own." part of the reason that I wanted to have you, the part of the reason I wanted to have you on the show was because I thought it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about both your theology and your politics, because one of the things that I have experienced in talking to you is it's so nice to talk to somebody who thinks like I do.
My sister, who's Libby Lou on Facebook.
Oh, okay.
She has, you know her, right? She's been a friend of yours for ages. And she has talked about you and Simca Fisher, you and Simca Fisher, to me for years. And I requested to be friends with you, and I started paying attention to what you were writing, because I didn't want to get involved in all these really... I hate to use political terms, but you know, all this infighting. And then you wrote something that just completely captured my attention when you said, we have to be more pro-life, not less. More pro-life, not less. And you broadened, you actually presented the seamless garment idea that Cardinal Bernardin came up with, is that all of life from conception to the grave is sacred, to natural death is sacred. And and that all of a sudden you're calling people on, you know, not just being anti-abortion. You have to be pro-life. You can't just, you know, you have to be against the death penalty. You have to question war. You know, all of these things. And that coincides so well with Catholic social teaching, and yet you articulated it in that one sentence, be more pro-life, not less. And so I thank you for that.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. I've been gratified to, you know, to see you making those points as well. And it really is just a kind of a reiteration of the Catholic tradition. It's Pope Benedict who kind of summed things up with, you know, human life is sacred from conception to natural death. And it seems so simple, but it's astonishing how hard it is for people to wrap their minds around that.
The other thing that you kind of enlightened us on is that, yes, we want Roe v. Wade to be repealed, but we have to do more than repeal the law. We can't, if it gets repealed, we can't sit back on our laurels and think that abortion doesn't happen just because mm-hmm. Roe v. Wade is no longer in force. It's
right.
still going to happen. We have to do.
Of course it is.
We should have something in place now for when,
right.
if it is appealed, are we just going to go off, put our head back in the sand? Anyway, that's my little thing.
And there's a reason that Roe became law in the first place. It's because the pressure to abort was already there, and if we're not doing anything about that pressure, which is the real issue ultimately, you know, a repeal of Roe isn't going to do anything. Although, frankly, Roe is not going to be repealed. I'd love for it to be, but it's just not going
to
happen.
As Christians or as pro-life people, to put all of our hope in the law is that that's going to switch it off. It's ridiculous.
Right.
Really just ridiculous. We have to do so much
right.
more than that.
Yeah, so we have to look at that, I think, from a supply and demand issue or perspective. And, you know, what we've been trying, our whole focus has been cut off supply. Well, if you cut off supply, but you don't do anything about demand, the supply is still going to be there. It's just going to be there, you know, under the counter somewhere.
Well, see, and that's why when, you know, to give women and people the support they need to to do something about rampant poverty and to give women a reason not to want to have an abortion, but to, you know, to keep the child. Well, and this, why did they get pregnant in the first place? Especially when we're talking about young people, you know, there's a great movie. It's a small movie. It's called Gimme Shelter. Mm. And I think it's with, Demi Lovato. Can't remember, but the woman on whose life that is based is amazing because she quietly has founded these homes starting in New Jersey for young women to bring their, you know, to go to when their parents kick them out when they get pregnant
mm-hmm.
out of, you know, when they're not married. And guess what? They keep them for life. They will always have a home. And
wow.
I tell you, the lady who founded the Gimme Shelter homes is a true mystic. When I met her, I was overwhelmed with the holiness. She herself had been in an abusive marriage, and her husband had kicked her out and put her on the street. And she was homeless. And it was she raised his children from another, I guess, previous marriage, and then he put her on the street, and she little by little came back. And when she finally got her a place to stay, she got a job, and she opened up the scriptures and she said, okay, God, what do you want me to do? And she, you know how you put your finger down in the gospel.
Yeah.
And that's what she did. And she got to the part, you know, to the spirit who gave me shelter, gave me shelter. And that's what she started doing. And What a story. You should get her on this radio show. Ooh.
Bad idea. You know, there's one of the little memes that I see floating around. It's a saying from John Chrysostom, says,
mm-hmm.
and I think that this is some of the most profound Catholic incarnational theology ever uttered. He said, if you do not see Christ in the beggar at the church door, you will not find him in the cup. And mm-hmm. I just think that that's so profound. And I think that one of the great tragic schisms in the church today is the schism between liturgical Catholicism that's all focused on the Eucharist and, if you will, social justice Catholicism that's focused on the beggar at the church door, as though they're opposites or have nothing to do with one another. And nothing can be further from the truth. And that's why I love that your theology is so incarnational, because it has to be that way. Those things have to be united. So I want to thank you so much, Sister Rose, for being on our show today. Your website, again, can be found where?
It's sisterrosemovies.net.
All right. And we will
thank
be looking
you,
forward
Mark.
To your... Oh, thanks for being on. We'll be looking forward to your book on St. Hildegard. And I want to thank you, Michael Lichtenz, for being on the show as well. Our producer
Always.
Today was Danny Head. And you've been listening to Connecting the Dots with me, your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back tomorrow with Mr. Rod Bennett. Until then, have a great evening and a happy, bright week.